these are just anecdotes, but it's building up into something more coherent.
And I think it'd be interesting to really try to unravel what his ties.
There's a sort of country-city divide.
They're inconvenient. Ends and it's not clear where it goes next.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Countless presidents have come to office promising to make government smaller. They almost all do. But no one has done so with quite as much conviction and consequence as Donald Trump. The government is vast. 2.8 million civilian employees whose jobs range from Forest Service firefighters to CIA code breakers. Trump has let many of the most crucial jobs absolutely languish, unfilled, even as tens of thousands of employees have quit or retired. In the midst of a confrontation with North Korea, we've had no ambassador to South Korea. Staff writer Evan Osnos spent months reporting on Trump's assault on the civil service. He interviewed dozens of government workers to look at just how this shift has changed the life of the government. Evan, when Donald Trump was running for office, how did he talk about staffing the government and the size of the government? What was his attitude toward government? Was it standard, kind of smaller government, conservative doctrine?
Well, he said at one point, "I'm going to cut so much it'll make your head spin." But then he also made another promise, which a lot of us remember, which is he said, "I'm going to fill the government with the best and most serious people." Those were his two promises. He has shaken up the government in ways that are really dramatic, actually, and frankly, in ways that don't really appear on the front page of the paper very often. We don't talk about what's going on in the ranks of the federal government. But if you look at the numbers, they're dramatic. In the first 9 months of the Trump administration, 79,000 civil servants left the government, which is much larger than the same period under the Obama administration. So there's tremendous turmoil beneath the surface of the water.
And what about the quality of the people?
What we've seen from the Trump administration, of course, is a huge amount of turmoil in the White House. There's been people coming and going. There's feuds. There's kind of factions. But the real problem has been that they're struggling to fill really crucial jobs across the government with people that know what they're doing. There are about 600 plus jobs that are the most crucial positions at the top of the federal agencies, and about half of those today are still unfilled. We've never had a situation like that, that number of vacancies, and that's because it's been very hard to find people to join who are both politically loyal, personally loyal to the president to the degree that he wants them to be, and then also skilled and expert enough to be able to pass the test.
What kind of jobs?
These are some of the most important jobs in the State Department. For instance, right now we have no ambassador to South Korea. Many of the most important jobs in diplomacy, what are assistant secretaries of state. And you see similar things like that in other departments, places where the president has decided that in order to be able to work for him, the most important piece of this is loyalty.
His supporters were always eager to compare him to Andrew Jackson, a kind of disruptive candidate and a man of the people who didn't stand on ceremony. You're suggesting another parallel based on how jobs are filled. What's that about?
Well, there's been this long-running debate in government about, do you want to fill jobs on the basis of partisan loyalty or on nonpartisan expertise? What's more important? And if you go back, Andrew Jackson believed, I want to fill the government with people who are personally loyal to me. And one of his friends in the Senate said, to the victor goes the spoils. And that famous declaration is how we got the spoils system, meaning that for most of the 19th century, the government was basically filled with people who were friends and allies of the president. Congress at the end of the 19th century said this is really no way to run a government. They got rid of it and they created the civil service, which is the thing we have today that says there are people who are professional experts. These are nonpartisan, merit-based jobs who rise up through the system.
So that was in the 19th century, Evan, but wasn't there an overhaul much later around the time of Richard Nixon?
There was, yeah. That, you know, Richard Nixon in particular was very wary of civil servants. He thought they were out to get him. He was paranoid about the subject. And internally, inside his White House, they created an instruction manual, which was a list of techniques, they called them, ways to try to marginalize civil servants. One of the things was to monitor people, give them grades on the basis of whether they seemed loyal to Nixon. And they also came up with methods, something they called the new activity technique, by which they meant you create a new activity that looks meaningful, but is in fact meaningless. And then you can assign hundreds or more staffers to that and basically sideline them, take them out of commission. And that was one of the things they did. And when that came to light as a result of Watergate, Congress passed a new round of laws that were really intended to try to protect civil servants and really try to protect the taxpayers' interests so that you didn't have presidents pushing large numbers of government employees into meaningless work.
And you spent months talking to civil servants. It's not usually considered the sexiest kind of political reporting in Washington. Right. But nevertheless, what are the ramifications of so many open jobs and so many dissatisfied civil servants in one bureaucracy after another in D.C.?
Well, that's the thing that I found really fascinating about this. Look, you know, civil service is the kind of thing that operates below the radar screen. It definitely doesn't make much traction on Twitter every day. But that's where the real meat of government goes on. Those are the people who are preparing to deal in complex negotiations with foreign countries. These are the people who are deciding what kind of information gets out to the public and what is ultimately sideline, what sort of debate they have, all kinds of issues. And what's become clear when you talk to enough people is there's tremendous pressure right now on civil servants ever since the Trump administration took office, pressure on them to do things that in many cases they feel is inappropriate, that's designed to protect the president's political interest, prevent embarrassment, not to do the work of the civil service, which is not supposed to be related to politics.
One man who did speak to you on the record, and you had quite a number of people speak to you on the record, is named Matthew Allen. Who is he and why is his story so significant?
Matthew Allen's an interesting case. He's a guy who grew up in Spokane, Washington, in sort of a ranching, mining family. Not somebody who ever naturally thought he was going to go into the federal government. Joined the Army, ended up working at the Department of Veterans Affairs, rose up through the ranks, ended up at the Pentagon working on the counter-ISIS campaign. So this is somebody who's a really seasoned civilian public affairs officer, knows his way around government, went over to the Department of the Interior shortly before Trump arrived. And what happened to him there is really a story of what's happening across the government. And he's found himself now sort of surprising himself, speaking out to say that he's concerned about what's happening in the ranks of the federal government. And he spoke to us for this.
And I know you're going to speak to him in a moment, but has he put himself in jeopardy by speaking out?
Well, in his view, he didn't really have a choice. He said, look, I can't continue to work in this government and not let it be known how worried I am about what's happening. And he's filed a case believing that he's been unfairly targeted for speaking out against the administration, and we'll see. He believes he has a strong case to make, and he is not going quietly. He is talking about it publicly in ways that a lot of civil servants, I think, frankly, are unwilling to do. It's risky.
Staff writer Evan Osnos. His article about the civil service is called Trump versus the Deep State. Here he is with Matthew Allen in Washington.
Matthew, when Trump took office, you were the communications director at the Bureau of Land Management at the Department of Interior. Ryan Zinke came in as the head of the Department of Interior, and what began to change?
There were a lot of changes as soon as the team walked through the door, and I think things felt like they constricted. The information flow felt like it slowed down, that certain people in a tight circle were involved with the meetings and the decision-making processes. And it made it difficult to understand which direction we were going.
So at a certain point, you received an order, and it had to do with Freedom of Information Act requests. What are they, and what were you asked to do with them?
The Freedom of Information Act permits anyone to petition the government to provide information related to whatever subject matter that they would like. So I was asked by leadership at the Bureau of Land Management to provide an opportunity to review a FOIA request that had to do with those specific individuals. In other words, leadership at the BLM wanted to have the chance to review FOIAs concerning themselves prior to public release.
Is that normal?
That was atypical. Having the approval authority rest with the individual with whom the information concerns seemed like a conflict of interest to me.
And you've worked at the Pentagon, you've worked elsewhere, Department of Veterans Affairs. Had you ever been asked to pass along FOIA requests to the people who were the subject of those inquiries?
No, never.
information, which is really the field in which you've been working, is something that the administration and Ryan Zinke at the Department of Interior put an enormous emphasis on. There's a lot of talk about controlling and maintaining and orienting the flow of information, making sure that the right people have it and the wrong people don't have it, in effect. And that came to impact your job because several memos were leaked in the spring of 2017, a couple months after the new administration had come in. And in those memos, it showed that Zinke intended to roll back protections on public land. What happened after they were leaked?
After they were leaked, there was sort of a push in the building amongst the leadership to find out who was leaking the documents and to prevent leaks of the documents. Folks stopped sending emails. They started producing things in limited hard copy only.
Stopped sending emails.
Correct. They stopped sending around draft documents via email. They would hand out documents at meetings, and the documents would be left at the meetings afterwards so that there were no copies that could be sent outside of the building. And that environment, in turn, seems to have spawned even more leaks, because certainly in the span since last summer, that's persisted, and we've seen numerous stories about other documents that had leaked and other conversations and email threads and things of that nature.
So after some of these documents leaked in the spring of last year, at some point, your superiors came to you and asked you to try to plug the leaks. Is that right?
Yes. There were a few conversations where first it was asked why I couldn't stop the leaks. And at the time, I had sort of framed it as, number one, I certainly don't have the resources to investigate information leaks. And second, I'm not sure if that's legal to do. So
when you said that, what was the reaction?
Then the reaction shifted from why can't you stop the leaks to veiled accusations that I was in fact the one leaking the information.
I mean, I got to ask, were you the one leaking the information?
I was not, no.
So you'd worked in a lot of different parts of the government. You've got a lot of experience in communications. Had you ever been asked to try to plug leaks like this before?
No, I had not. And what struck me was, having just beforehand worked at the Department of Defense in what is probably one of the most sensitive current operations that the United States is undertaking, we would still have not leaks of that nature, but information still traveled, and we would address it as professionals, and we would have conversations with reporters, and we would have conversations with different units that were in those areas of Iraq and Syria. And in this situation at the BLM and with the Department of Interior, the level of concern, perhaps even borderline paranoia about the leaks, didn't quite warrant the situation. In my mind, if the administration or the secretary or the Bureau of Land Management is going to make a decision or take an action, part of what we're accountable to the American people to provide is our rationale and our reasoning behind why we're taking that action. And it felt to me like there was a reluctance to do that.
There was a reluctance to sort of talk about how they were reaching decisions.
Correct.
And what happened after that?
In the midst of the leak to the Washington Post related to the Monuments Review, I was removed from my position and placed into a staff role at the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement.
Your experience, your training, everything that the government's invested in you over the years has been to help you become a communications professional. Are you now using those skills in this job?
No, I am not.
And is this a promotion, a lateral move, something else?
This would definitely be considered a demotion.
A demotion. In Washington, as you know, there's an old saying that when they want to move a civil servant out of a job to get rid of them, in effect, that they are turkey farmed. They're sent to a job that has no particular urgency or no sort of central role in the decision making. It sounds to me as if that's more or less what happened to you.
I would say that the position they put me in certainly feels like the intention was that I would have no direct access or intersection with the media, with Congress, with external organizations or non-governmental organizations who had received leaked documents from the building.
Some people might wonder as they hear you talking about your experience, they say, well, you know, the president won an election. This is his government. You took an oath. Why don't you just do what the president and his cabinet wants you to do?
I think in the circumstance we're talking about, we were there and prepared to do what the president asked of us. The challenge was that we never had the opportunity to do so. My colleagues and I were removed from our positions as soon as it was legally feasible for those types of movements to happen. And it was unprecedented that that sheer quantity of senior executives that was relocated last year and reassigned hadn't been done before, never in mass and never for what really appears to be politically motivated reasons.
You know, Matthew, you've been now in a kind of confrontation with the department. Why haven't you quit? Why do you stay?
You know, what's interesting is in 8 months, nobody's actually asked me that question. I feel that I took my oath to the Constitution and not to an office and not to an individual. And I serve the American people. And what I've devoted my career to is communicating to the American people what actions their government is taking on their behalf. And I felt that if I were to leave just because things had become unpleasant or difficult, I would be doing a disservice because there are still ways that I can help communicate.
Why did you decide to speak out publicly?
Yeah, so one of my philosophies on communication is maximum disclosure and minimum delay. And it feels to me that I can't be in a position where I'm asking the agency I work for to do that and where I'm asking my employees to do that if I'm not willing to live that as well.
Matthew Allen, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
The New Yorker's Evan Osnos speaking with Matthew Allen of the Department of the Interior in Washington. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Get it downstairs, and I want the page editor standing over Lino till they got it ready to print.
Okay.
Bob Odenkirk isn't a newsman, but he did a pretty good job of playing one in the movie The Post.
Did you get the study from the same source as The Times?
We did not reveal our sources.
Hey, Bob Odenkirk here, the actor. When you're acting, you have a fair amount of downtime. So instead of drinking too much or playing golf, I've been reading the newspaper. Turns out a lot has happened since Donald Trump took office, and we've all been skipping over news stories that aren't about him and his antics. So in the spirit of public enlightenment, I wanted to tell you about some news that you may have overlooked. Goodbye, big crack. The Grand Canyon has collapsed. Apparently, there was some kind of earthquake-windstorm combination that caused the canyon's sides to crumble. 392 people died. You knew 10 of them personally. Two were your cousins, and they had texted you pictures of themselves standing on the rim, waving. Final fish flounder. 3 weeks from now, the world's final piece of high-grade sushi will be consumed. After that, there will only be farm-raised catfish. Overfishing and pollution have been obvious problems for a while now, and this was a situation that clearly could have been avoided, but, you know, enjoy your farm-raised catfish sushi. Special moments. Your first granddaughter was born 3 months ago. This happened on a presidential tweet storm day, so you were preoccupied. Her name is either Eileen or Ellen. You should visit her. Neighbor down. Your elderly neighbor was murdered right in front of you in broad daylight. You were cleaning the gutters and listening to an interview with Justin Trudeau on NPR when about 30 feet away, a man wearing a hockey mask used a machete to mince old Mrs. Samuelson to bits as she returned from the store with a bag of parakeet treats. In sports, the Super Bowl happened again, and you missed it. Seriously, you missed a Super Bowl. Think about that. And in extremely personal news, your medical test came back positive. The doctor gives you 6 months. It's seriously time to turn off the TV, put down the newspaper, and, I don't know, open your mail, have a conversation, maybe just sit quietly and take it all in. But wait, I'm getting a report that the test results came back 5.5 months ago, so it's already too late. This is Bob Odenkirk. That's the news you missed. And now, back to All Trump, All the Time.
That's Bob Odenkirk with headlines you may have missed. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Coming up in a minute, we'll talk World Cup with a soccer expert and a newly minted American, Roger Bennett, of Men in Blazers. Stick around. I'm David Remnick. The World Cup begins this week. But soccer in America is still a kind of acquired taste. And especially this year because our national team failed to qualify to compete for the most watched sporting event on the planet. We don't even get to compete. It's a real blow for fans, especially Roger Bennett. Bennett is kind of a rare bird. He's an Englishman who's devoted to American soccer. And he lives here while co-hosting the soccer podcast called Men in Blazers from NBC Sports. Bennett came to the studio to talk with Michael Luo about what's wrong with American soccer. Luo is a former captain of the Losser High School varsity team in Michigan. He's also, incidentally, the editor of NewYorker.com.
When I remember taking notice of you guys was during the 2014 World Cup when you somehow got a gig broadcasting from what seemed like a closet during the World Cup. And then after that, you got a show on NBC Sports Network.
Just made it sound like the early scenes of Scarface. We arrived in America with nothing, and suddenly we're running a mid-sized
an cartel empire. How did you, a British guy from Liverpool, a long-suffering fan of Everton, end up making a living basically riffing about soccer?
We were just beneficiaries of great timing, to be candid. I arrived in America in 1993. I loved America for the longest time. I actually grew up in Liverpool in the 80s, the greatest city in the world. But when I grew up, fairly dark economically, the Thatcher era, and I'd watch a steady stream of American television, heart to heart, Fantasy Island, The Love Boat, Charles in Charge, and each show, it just seemed like life was lived in Technicolor in America. And I always dreamed of moving there. And I moved there just when the World Cup came to America. And I watched the American team in 1994 swagger onto that field, ginger of beard, mulleted of hair. And I loved it. I just looked at these American guys and I thought, I love this. I love this country. I love this team. I love the possibility of the growth of the game here. And all I wanted to do was just dedicate my life to the growth of the game. I love soccer in the country. I love America.
So take us back to 1994 and what that point meant for American soccer.
So to understand 1994, the year that America hosted the World Cup, you have to understand what football was like before it. You know, when I drove in 1990, I drove around Maine. I was a college counselor, desperate to watch England in the semi-finals of the World Cup. Not a single bar was willing to pull the signal down on a huge satellite dish. They all wanted to watch the Portland Sea Dogs minor league baseball game. They looked at me like I was a madman. 94 changed all of that. The American team swaggered onto that field. They grabbed the world's attention. They got through the group stage. They played Brazil. They looked mighty Brazil, the eventual winners, in the eye on July 4th, no less, lost in a unbelievably brutal encounter. But that World Cup, it made America's pulse absolutely thicken around this sport. The American players started to be coveted after that World Cup. They were the new heroes. They were on Wheaties boxes. You know, Letterman wanted them. NFL teams tried to recruit them to be kickers. Hollywood agents wanted them to star in movies. And European elite teams suddenly wanted the American, and they got jobs abroad. Alexi Lalas, he plays for a team in Padua. And in our podcast, American Fiasco, Eric Winalda tells the story of flying in after his Bundesliga game in Germany to pick up Alexi Lalas, who's played in the Serie A, scored a goal in a massive game. And Alexi says, let's go for dinner. And he goes, where are we going to go? He goes, well, there's a restaurant on a tiny island outside of Venice that's almost impossible to get into. We'll go there. And they get out on like a James Bond cigar boat. They just zoom out there and there's a huge line outside. There's no way they're getting in. And Lalas just pushes to the front of the line. And the maitre d' is like, oh, Lalas is here. And just suddenly, like in Goodfellas, a table is whisked in out of nowhere, put down. They're given the pride of place. Suddenly, on a small stage, a spotlight goes on. And everyone in this elite restaurant is clapping, saying, Lalas, please sing for us. And Alexi stops eating his pasta, strolls onto the stage and plays his latest cut from his album, Ginger. And when Elder says, I looked at it, and he knew a year ago, Alexi Lalas was earning like a $5 a day per diem. And suddenly he's living a life which is a mixture of Mick Jagger and James Bond, plus Pelé kind of thrown into the mix. And that's how fast and how far soccer came.
So you have recently done a podcast about the 1998 World Cup in France, a series called American Fiasco, which I've been listening to. And that was a moment of profound disappointment for the American team. So we'll talk about 1998 when the United States finished dead last, if you were to count goal differential in France, most embarrassingly losing to Iran. Remind us of what happened. I mean,
it was like if you've watched the movie Apocalypse Now, then you pretty well catch the last year of this campaign. I mean, the American mentality, Michael, is an amazing thing. One of many reasons I love your country, which is about to become mine on Friday. I'm actually about to be sworn as an American citizen.
Congratulations.
God, it's genuinely the greatest thing I've ever done. But the American mentality is, we can do this. 90, we qualified, showed the world we could qualify. 94, we showed the world we can belong. What are we going to do in 1998? You know, we, the people who put the man on the moon, we, the people who put a Starbucks on every street corner, we're going to go and we're going to win the bloody World Cup. And what I was fascinated by was the series of decisions, many, many decisions, almost all of them awfully made, that along the way, one after another, combined to just turn a footballing culture that felt that nothing could stop it. And through human decision, one awful decision after another, and it was just became a march of folly. They didn't just destroy the US's World Cup campaign, they destroyed the sport's future. The stakes were so high, they needed the new league to grow. They needed to keep building on 94. You know, the sport lost a ton of sponsors. Americans turned away from soccer in droves. And it was really only the women, the US women, as so often, as please God they will next year, came in 1999 to save the day by winning the World Cup. And it took about a decade for the sport to really get back to where it was in terms of regaining the trust of the American public.
We can go World Cup by World Cup, but why don't we talk about obviously the most recent fiasco, America's failure to qualify for the World Cup. Did you have a feeling, deja vu a little bit? Are there parallels between the American fiasco in 1998 and this campaign?
The 2018 era where they needed to draw against Trinidad and Tobago, the worst team in qualifying. They failed to get one. We should never play two countries again at the same time. No more ands. Let's not get cocky, kid.
Yes.
Let's just play one country at a time. We'll be okay. 1998 was just one terrible decision in retrospect, taking each one, learning from the last mistake to kind of reinforce its cruelty and idiocy. 2018 has a similar trail of destruction that led to the failure in terms of the leadership. There was a massive leadership transformation. There was an arrogance amongst the players. There was a sense of entitlement. And what still remains the same from 1998 to 2018, and we still have not solved this problem, US soccer is remarkably unique and distinct in that It's an incredibly suburban sport still. I did a study with a Princeton academic, Greg Kaplan, before the last World Cup, where we studied the socioeconomic culture of every World Cup squad going back to 1990. And socially and economically, just off the radar, the US soccer player, their financial background, their levels of education, just the zip codes they came from, it's an incredibly suburban mentality. The American player, when they go to Europe, very often when you interview the players, they can't believe the level of cutthroat competition that exists and the level of accountability. The foreign players that come to the American League, they can't believe when you lose a big game. You know, talking to some of the massive players that have come, they'll say, I can't believe you lose a massive game, a derby here. And people are like, okay, cool, what are we playing next? And, you know, he said, when I played for Milan, if you lost, you did not show your face for a week and you trained with triple ferocity and you needed to get the press off your back. None of that accountability exists. There's something deeply parochial still at the heart of US soccer. And until we work it out how to eradicate that, it's always going to be a nearly sport from a professional perspective.
How big of a setback is this for US soccer?
2018, the US did not make the World Cup. It's devastating for the players. It's devastating for the fans. It's bad for human beings who love to have memories, great memories of Landon Donovan scoring against Algeria, of Jonathan Brooks, the young German-American who scored a late winner in the first goal game of the 2014 World Cup against Ghana.
Julian Green, the single best moment of his soccer life.
Good, Julian, good! So we will not have bona fide American memories, but the honest truth is the 2018 World Cup is not a matter of will Americans watch, will they not watch. The honest truth is the World Cup has become such a well-ingrained circus, a telenovela of heroes and villains and moments of human wonder and disaster and awful haircuts and ill-judged neck tattoos. And Americans, they love nothing more than a circus, Michael. They love an excuse to daytime drink. We always joke, if you're in a bar at 7:30 in the morning, you know, society frowns on that behavior. But if you're in that same bar and on the television, Russia are playing Saudi Arabia in the World Cup, you're a football fan. And for that reason, if no other, America will adore, will revere, will savor in the thing.
Who, for our listeners who are maybe casual soccer fans, who should they be rooting for in this World Cup?
So you've got Iceland, this joyous little nation. Who truly believe Viking blood flows through their veins. So they're playing against Argentina in the first game. They think they're going to step onto that field and slay Argentina. I just love that self-confidence. You've got the greatest story in soccer, Ronaldo and Messi, the two, for a decade, just dueling greats. But if either one of them, Argentina, Messi, Portugal, Ronaldo, go deep in this tournament and win it, it will cement either man's legend as truly the greatest of all time.
I'll close with this reading from the back of your new book, Encyclopedia Blazer-Tanica. Soccer has been America's sport of the future since 1972, propelled by the rise of the World Cup, Premier League, the glory of the United States women's national team, Lionel Messi's demigoddesque talent, and repeat exposure to Cristiano Ronaldo's pre-nabs. That future has finally arrived. When I read that, I was trying to figure out if you were joking or not. And after our conversation, I realized that you were being serious.
Yeah. If, below the age of 27, soccer is between the second and third biggest sport. When Americans are asked by the ESPN sports poll to name their favorite athlete in the world, Ronaldo and Messi are in the top 10. 72,000 fans will go and watch Atlanta play on a regular basis. All of which is to say, football, soccer, whatever you want to call it, is very much here. And it's why to call it America's sport of the future, as it has been since 1972, is such a warm delight for us, because we know that we're joking. It's very much here, Michael.
Roger Bennett is co-host of Men in Blazers. Bennett has just released American Fiasco, a particularly painful podcast from WNYC Studios about the epic U.S. fail in the 1998 World Cup. Michael Luo is the head of all of our digital platforms at The New Yorker. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The hurricane season of 2018 has officially started, and we've got to pray that it's not like last year's, which brought destruction and death to Houston, Puerto Rico, and much of the Caribbean. Some of the people who will be watching most closely are the residents of Tangier Island in the Chesapeake Bay. Tangier sits nearly at sea level and is in dire peril from any storm that hits the mid-Atlantic. The New Yorker's Carolyn Corman visited the island along with the Radio Hour's Sarah Nix last year just as a storm was heading in.
We're with the mayor, headed out to rescue a baby osprey. How old do you think it is?
Two babies.
They're not ready to fly yet, and they might be in trouble with the storm coming tomorrow. There's a big storm moving toward a low strip of land called Tangier Island. The island's mayor, James Eskridge, is moving a pair of juvenile osprey, big birds of prey that live on the water, to safety.
There was a pair last year, almost ready to fly. We had a strong thunderstorm, and when I went back to it, the birds were going, swept them out of the nest.
The mayor's at the wheel of his skiff. He's a tall guy, he has a big mustache, and you can really see all the years he's spent on the water and his skin. It's deeply tanned, permanently windburned.
Cameron, you want these?
The osprey nest is in the harbor on a platform that's only about a yard above the water. The waves are lapping up underneath it. The mayor's brought 17-year-old Cameron Evans to help him with the rescue.
You want these thick gloves? I got a net.
Cameron leans out of the boat to scoop the bird up.
Don't get cold. Tell me when you got him. Got him? They don't think so right now, but it's further. I'm good.
Birds aren't the only thing that could lose their home in a big storm. The islanders could, too.
The mayor pulls his boat up to the shoreline. It's really just a few inches of sand with a little bit of topsoil that's all held together by the roots of the shore grass. It's not a rocky shore.
Yeah, this material, it's so soft. We need a shoreline like Maine's got. If this was rock along here, this would be here until the Lord comes back.
Tangier Island is not much more than 1 square mile, and it's shrinking rapidly. It's a third the size it was when it was first settled in the 18th century. People used to live on islands all over the bay, but now Tangier is one of only 2 inhabited offshore islands left. Climate change is tripling or even quadrupling the rate at which land is disappearing. And the 450 people who live here could be among the first climate change refugees in the United States.
The storm's blown in, and the wind is howling through the town at 40 or 50 miles an hour. The water's high in the tidal rivers and canals that cut through the island.
This morning at high tide around 6 a.m., the water level was up to the floor of the house, a little house behind where we're staying. Many of the pathways across the island were covered in water, unpassable.
And the wind, you can see the rain kind of coming across in sheets like it does in coastal storms.
Yes, we're not living on a piece of dry land here.
Usually the island's narrow lanes are full of golf carts and scooters, kids tossing footballs. When the sun is shining, it's got a kind of Norman Rockwell feel. Today, everyone is staying inside.
We're supposed to be on a boat back to the mainland, but the ferries aren't running.
Was that thunder?
No. We're sheltering on the porch of the island's only school, K through 12.
Let's go in.
It's where Trenna Moore has been teaching high school math for 18 years.
Not at all.
She grew up here, she married her high school sweetheart, and she raised her own kids here.
10 years ago, I had 5 generations living on the island. My grandmother died at 102. She was a devout Christian, and she is the one who got the vision from the Lord that we were going to get our first seawall. She stood up in church and said, "The Lord has given me, I've had a vision." And then 2 years later, we had the seawall dedication. And she
nearly 30 years ago, a seawall was built on part of the western side of Tangier Island. It's basically a line of huge boulders. It takes the brunt of the waves.
My childhood, before the seawall was there, we used to mark it like...
What does that mean, you would mark it?
Like get big posts and like what was there last year, and all winter we would walk down there and just watch that go out to sea.
Moore and other Tangier residents have been watching their island wash away for as long as they can remember. The difference the Western seawall has made has many of them praying for a wall all the way around the island.
The Lord gave my grandmother a word. I don't know if the Lord's given it. The Lord's not given me a word that we're going to get a seawall. But I am going to give that to the Lord. And if they want to say climate change, I do believe in climate change. I really do. But I believe in what it says, like centimeters a year. We are losing feet. You can see pictures of our island from when 20 years ago. It's half of that all the way around. The only part that hasn't been eroded in 20 years is the part with the seawall.
When Moore looks at what's happening to Tangier, she sees fast-acting erosion, not the climate change that's making it worse. A warming planet means more storms and stronger waves, and when salt water floods the land, like it is right now, it kills the trees, the grasses, the other vegetation that hold the sand and the topsoil together.
Climate change, when you read about that, isn't it like little bit? We're losing feet. And it's noticeable feet. Do I think climate change is an issue? I mean, I read about in Florida, you know, how they're losing parts of their land, and they're like in southern Florida, they say it's because climate change. Now, do I know that it's climate change? I don't know that. I'm reading it, and I'm assuming people that are smart in that area know what they're talking about. I'm not going to get into the Al Gore thing, but do I think that was handled correctly? No.
We're here for a special CNN town hall on the climate crisis with former Vice President Al Gore. I'm Anderson Cooper. I want to welcome...
Because of what's happening on Tangier, the island has become an object lesson in climate change for some people. This summer, CNN invited James Eskridge, the mayor of Tangier, to be a part of a town hall about climate change.
Mayor, welcome.
Thank you. Vice President Gore, Mr. Cooper, I'm a commercial crabber, and I've been working in the Chesapeake Bay for 50-plus years. I'm not a scientist, but I'm a keen observer. Our island is disappearing, but it's because of erosion and not sea level rise.
He's wearing a checked button-down shirt and a Tangier Island ball cap, and he looks comfortable on the set, entirely relaxed, holding the mic.
Back to the question, why am I not seeing signs of the sea level rise?
What do you think the erosion is due to, Mayor?
Wave action, storms.
Has that increased any?
Not really.
So you're losing the island even though the waves haven't increased.
Gore talked about how hard it can be to translate science into something people can understand and see. Then he told a kind of jokey story.
Reminds me a little bit of a story from Tennessee about a guy that was trapped in a flood. He was sitting on the front porch, and they came by in an SUV to rescue him, and he said, "No, the Lord will provide." And water kept on rising. He went up to the second floor, and they came by the window in a boat, said, "Come on, we're here to rescue." He said, "Nope, the Lord will provide." Then he went on up to the rooftop as the water kept rising, and they came over in a helicopter and dropped a rope ladder. He said, "Nope, Lord will provide." Well, he died in the water and went to heaven. He said, "God, I thought you were going to provide." And he said, "What do you mean? I sent you an SUV, a boat, and a helicopter." And I think that what we have heaven sent, so to speak.
Why would you say that to an island that's counting on God?
Trinamore watched the CNN event.
What did that have to do with us? So we're saying that if we don't listen and agree with climate change, go ahead and stay here and drown, and the Lord will provide? See, what other conclusion could we come to for that joke?
It could also be taken to mean that leaving the island would solve their problem, or that there may be a solution other than a seawall. But Al Gore didn't offer any suggestion about how Eskridge and the other islanders can save their community.
So that's what I couldn't understand, why this great man in climate change to joke. I was offended. I was offended as a Christian and as a Tangierman, because we need more than a story about drowning and going to heaven from the Vice President of the United States.
How you see Tangier's predicament depends on where you look. People who are looking for evidence of climate change see it in action on the island. People who live there, watching erosion for as long as they can remember, they see erosion. If the people who are wading through floodwaters regularly still don't believe that the climate is changing, maybe that's a testament to how difficult it is for any of us to see.
How much of your day every day do you think you spend considering the weather?
Probably 60% of it. Yeah. Weather is our life. Yeah.
Eskridge is showing us around his crab shanty. He's got dozens of blue crabs in tanks out here.
We bring the peeler crabs in and we dump them in these tanks. That's what my father used to do and grandfather before him.
He's waiting for them to molt so he can sell them as soft shell crabs, Tangier's specialty.
Oh, this one's shedding right now, and so is that one, right?
Yeah, yep. They're called busters.
Who's this?
This is Sam Alito.
He looks like a stately old gentleman.
Yeah, yep.
The mayor's also got cats out of the shanty.
We were having a tropical system, and there was a tree stump drifting in the storm, and there was four kittens hanging onto it. I guess they came from the island, but I went out and picked them up, and they've been here ever since. And they're a conservative group. It's Sam Alito and John Roberts, Condi Rice, and Ann Coulter.
He's been working from this spot since he graduated from high school in 1976. The building is about the size of a one-car garage, and it's perched on pilings in the harbor. He points to those pilings and says the high water mark is right where it's always been. And that's why he doesn't believe that climate change is causing the sea level to rise.
We've had people coming for years about the erosion problem here. I had a lady that told me, Mayor, whether you believe in climate change, in sea level rise or not, go along with it, because you may get funding to save your island.
Who told you that?
Some lady. Some lady told me. She, you know, just visiting. She was in the government. That's all I'm going to say about that. She said, go along with it. Go along with it, and you may get the funding you need, because that's the argument of today. And after, I did a couple interviews after that, and I would mention sea level rise and climate change in it, and I felt real dirty inside. So I stopped doing it. I said, I can't do it. I don't believe it. I don't believe it. I can't do it.
I spoke with a scientist named David Schulte, who studied the impacts of climate change on Tangier Island. And he confirmed to me that the water level is rising in the Chesapeake, and that it's forecast to rise up to 2 feet within this century if greenhouse gas emissions continue to increase. At its highest point, Tangier Island is only 4 feet above sea level.
Scientists say a seawall all around the island would make it more likely that people could be living there into the next century, but it would cost, at the very least, $30 million, and maybe into the hundreds of millions.
It's a huge amount of money to us, but to the government, it's not a lot of money. Myself and President Trump are on the same page when he talks about America first. I believe in helping folks out all around the world, and we should do that, but we're right here, 50 miles from D.C., and we need help.
It looked like that help might be on its way this summer when Donald Trump called the mayor. A news spot had gone out about how 90% of the islanders voted for Trump, and Eskridge said he loved the new president like a member of his own family.
Sure enough, he gave me a call Monday afternoon. And
how long was the call? What did you guys talk about?
Maybe 10 or 12 minutes. He thanked me and the town for our support. And we discussed sea level rise. President Trump and myself, we're on the same page. We don't see the sea level rise as a threatening thing. I mean, I myself, I don't see it happening. the changes that I'm seeing, I believe it, a lot of the changes are just natural cycles, ups and downs. I mean, myself and Donald Trump talked about that. He said, you know, Tangier's been here for hundreds of years and it'll be here for hundreds more.
It's not clear what Trump meant with his reassurance that Tangier Island will be here hundreds of years from now. And there's been no follow-up since that call. But when word got out about it, Eskridge did hear from other people.
Folks on the island were very excited, but some folks on the mainland, you know, some folks were not very happy with it. We got some hate mail and phone calls.
They called him at home, at his wife's business, and at the town office. There were messages saying the people of Tangier were stupid for voting for Donald Trump. And some people said they hoped the islanders would drown. But those letters and phone calls weren't the only fallout. Later that week, Stephen Colbert brought it up on his show.
Their mayor believes there is a solution to coastal erosion. They need a jetty or perhaps even a seawall around the entire island, and that Trump will cut through red tape and get them that wall. Yes. Trump is going to get them that wall and then make the ocean pay for it.
Stephen Colbert completely blew us off.
Yeah. No, that's all right. I was mentioned on Stephen Colbert publicity. I don't mind it.
Although he shrugs it off, Eskridge has stepped into a hornet's nest of politics about climate change and the new president. But there is one thing that the mayor and more, Cameron and the scientists, can all agree on.
Oh, yeah, if we were to get a hurricane to come in and get like a 130-mile wind like they got in parts of Texas, yeah, it would wipe out the whole harbor here and probably a good chunk of the island.
After the storm, Eskridge and Cameron take the two juvenile osprey back to their nest. Then they stop at the north end of the island to check out what the storm has done to the coastline. There used to be other towns up here, Oyster Creek, Cannon, Reubentown. There used to be farms and houses and cemeteries. They're all long gone. Cameron comes up here to look for arrowheads that are left behind from when Native Americans hunted here.
But now, more land is being lost, and it's just bringing up stuff. Like foundations of houses up on Cannon, caskets will come out. So like
caskets.
Past people have been buried. When I was out up there arrowheading, I was walking where the graveyard used to be, looking around, and I was standing on a casket. I saw the frame of the casket, then I looked down and I saw the body. But I could see the ring on her finger. I could tell it was a woman. I was young and I had never saw a body before, and that wasn't a very pretty way to see it, but it was hard to take in.
Cameron's finishing high school this year. He wants to go to college, and then he wants to live and work here on the island.
And if we do wash away, I'm really not gonna have that hometown anymore to come to. Everybody knows everybody, and you build memories upon those people. I know every single person on the island. I know where to live, who they're related to, their animals, their vehicles. It's harder for a person who doesn't live here to think about it because they're not really living it.
It's only natural that you'd want to save your community. They say it's not enough people, but and they say, you know, just leave the island and start over, but that's not easy to do, just abandon your home and your business. When I talk about saving Tangier Island, I'm not just talking about saving the island or the land. I'm talking about saving the people, our way of life, and our culture.
Eskridge points out a big white cross that he's planted in the harbor. God is life is written on it.
Some folks say even without a seawall, they said if God is finished with Tangier, then there's nothing going to keep us here. But if he still has work for us to do, then nothing's going to take us away from here.
It's a helpful way to accept having to leave your home.
And some folks, you know, some folks, if we didn't get the help we need, some folks would probably, you know, abandon the island eventually and move to the mainland. But myself and some more, you know, we're going to stay here as long as possible.
James Eskridge, the mayor of Tangier, Virginia, along with Carolyn Corman and Sarah Nix in 2017. I'm David Remnick, and that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for this week. Thanks so much for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.